Welcome to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name's Jeff Mann, and I'm the founder and editor of sleepjunkies.com. And what do we do on the podcast? Well, we cover the whole conversation on sleep. And today we're going to be talking about natural medicine. We're going to talk about naturopathy, natural sleep remedies. And before you switch off and think this is going to be a talk full of quackery, snake oil, and pseudoscience, take a pause. Okay, so the problem with natural medicine and natural therapies, whether they're for sleep or any other health condition, is not to do with efficacy, it's not to do with research, it's to do with the fact that there are people out there pretending to be experts, pretending to be medical advisors who aren't, and they are quacks. They've maybe done an online certification course. They have no idea about what they're prescribing. They have no training to do with patients. On the flip side, there are people like our guest today who have studied, who've been through degree programs, who've undertaken research in the lab, have done clinical research, have published scientific papers in the field of natural medicine. And the problem is, all of these people get lumped together. And as a result, the whole field of natural medicine gets smeared and tarnished. So today we're hoping to redress that balance a little bit and cut through some of the BS, talk about these issues, talk about the stigmas, talk about the fake stuff out there, but also talk about the real science behind natural medicine. We're going to talk about different herbs and supplements, drill down into some of the common ones and maybe some you haven't heard of before. We're going to talk about the different approach to health and well-being that natural medicine takes, considering the holistic health of the individual. We're going to talk about how naturopathic medicine works alongside traditional healthcare providers. So hopefully you'll get a real overview of this subject of naturopathy, and it certainly I've learned a lot on this podcast. So that's it for the introduction. If you're liking the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, leave us a review, check us out on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and of course on the website sleepjunkies.com. Hope you enjoy the episode. On with the show. Okay, so I'm joined today with Dr. Josh Korn, and I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation today because we're talking about natural medicine and how that relates to sleep. So hi, Josh, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, glad to be here.
Okay, can we get a little bit of a background to what you do, your training, and how would you describe yourself? Would you describe yourself as a naturopath, a naturopathic doctor? What's your title, you would say, if you met somebody at a dinner party, let's say?
Sure, good question. I describe myself as a naturopathic doctor because I have a degree in naturopathic medicine. In the United States, and I think kind of throughout the world, naturopathy or naturopathic medicine doesn't have as many standards and kind of educational requirements as it does in some places in this country. So anyone who's into natural medicine or into, you know, traditional healing can kind of call themselves a naturopath. So I think that's an important distinction to make, that I have had extra training and have gone to a, you know, degree program and actually seen patients and all that kind of stuff.
Just to clarify, are you saying there's less standards in the States or less standards in other countries compared to the States?
I think different states and different countries have different standards for, you know, who can call themselves a naturopath, who can call themselves a naturopathic doctor. For instance, in the state of Oregon in the US where I practice, anyone who calls themselves a naturopathic doctor has to have gone to a 4-year accredited program, you know, a clinical program, and actually seen patients and passed board exams and get licensed by the state.
Okay.
Whereas in there are other states in the country where there aren't licensing requirements.
Well, we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but I think people have a lot of preconceptions about what a naturopath is, and this distinction between a naturopathic doctor and a naturopath. That's something I wasn't aware of before this conversation. Mm-hmm. So can we talk a little bit about the training, and also, you know, you've got a research background in this field as well.
Yes. So I attended National University of Natural Medicine, excuse me, which is the oldest naturopathic school in North America. It's been around since 1956 as its own entity. Before that, it was affiliated with another college. So it's been turning out students for the past 60 years. My training was really focused on both kind of traditional primary care aspects of standards of care as far as diagnosis and ordering labs and imaging and all that kind of stuff, but really with a heavy emphasis on natural therapies that can treat disease. So herbal medicine, lifestyle as far as like stress management, sleep is a big thing we talk about, exercise, and then diet and food as medicine is one of the really huge components of our program and naturopathic practice in general. And with the research, I did an integrative medicine research master's degree while I was in school, worked on a few clinical trials and have worked on some bench work and just kind of, you know, collaborating with lots of different doctors who were doing research in different areas.
So can you distill what is a naturopath? What does a naturopath do? And where does this practice of naturopathic medicine fit into the whole scheme of health? Let's keep it limited to the States, maybe to, you know, to your, sure, your state of Oregon as well.
Sure. In, you know, in the state of Oregon, naturopathic doctors can function as primary care providers, which fills a really big gap in the current U.S. healthcare system. There aren't enough primary care providers for all the people that need them. So I think we fill a really important role in this state and a few other states where we're licensed as PCPs. My practice is probably 70% primary care, I would say, and probably about 30% complementary care. Most of my patients are low income, uninsured, or Medicaid. We work with some of the county organizations here to provide care to patients who, you know, have no other way to get health care than besides through the county. So we partner with them. I also work in a drug and alcohol rehab center. So I work with patients who are, you know, in recovery for those things. And mostly there I do complementary care. And I find that to be really rewarding because those are people that normally don't have access to, you know, anything but kind of standard of care, basic health care. And it's really cool to see natural things work with those people and see those people kind of take charge of their health and start learning to take care of themselves in ways that they haven't done. So I love being a part of that as well.
As a naturopathic doctor, you're kind of looking at the individual as a whole, and it's a slightly different approach to going to your regular doctor. Is it fair to say naturopathy is considering the holistic health of the individual?
Yeah, absolutely. That's foundational to our medicine is that whole person, individual care, you know, really looking at every part of your health and every part of what you do and how you eat and how you sleep and how you exercise and how you interact with other people, because all of those things play into our health. There's tons of research on kind of what's called the social determinants of health. So all those pieces of health that don't, you know, they don't fit in your body, in your physical space. And then additionally, like all of the research, especially new research that's coming out about how powerful our mental health and our mind and our cognitive function, like how those really make an impact on our health. So naturopathic doctors are really trained to, we really get into it. We love spending a lot of time with our patients, talking about all those things, you know, talking about sleep, talking about stress levels, talking about your mood, talking about your poop. We love to talk about digestion and kind of, you know, looking at everything and how it's all interconnected. And yeah, I do think sleep is a really excellent example because there's a lot of different ways that I treat sleep issues. I don't have just a one size fits all approach.
Great. Yeah, we'll get into that in a little bit. What I want to do, I want to dispel a few myths and maybe some misperceptions and some stigmas about this, because there's probably some people who may look at this podcast or even the title of the podcast and they see natural medicine or naturopathy and they think, right, okay, right, I know exactly what that's going to be at. You know, that's going right. to be some, you know, hippy dippy, zero evidence based talking about some nonsense, basically. So I went to the the Wikipedia page for naturopathy, and I'm just going to read it out for the readers here because it's really interesting. So I'll just read out a couple of these passages. So it says, this is from Wikipedia. So if you type this into Wikipedia, naturopathy or naturopathic medicine is a form of alternative medicine that employs an array of pseudo-scientific practices. The ideology and methods of naturopathy are based on vitalism and folk medicine rather than evidence-based medicine. Naturopathic practitioners generally recommend against following modern medical practices, including medical testing, drugs, vaccinations, and surgery. Natural medicine is considered by the medical profession to be ineffective and possibly harmful, raising ethical issues about its practice. There you go.
Yes. thank you for bringing that up. I think it's it's shocking to that's me quite, how different that is from how naturopathic doctors really practice.
I find that quite shocking because it's saying it's all based on vitalism and folk medicine rather than evidence-based medicine. Mm-hmm. And then they say pseudoscientific. What's pseudoscientific? Mm-hmm. You recommend against drugs, vaccinations, and surgery. So if someone came to you with a broken leg, you know, you wouldn't recommend they go to a hospital to get it fixed, according to this Wikipedia.
Yeah, according to that.
According to this. So this seems like, not to use a strong word, this seems like a bit of propaganda here.
Certainly. And I think that, you know, understanding your sources is really important. And Wikipedia is a great source of information because everybody can edit it. But the problem is that everybody can edit it. So that means that it's not an unbiased source of information. I think we could spend the whole time really unpacking this. But I think the thing that's most, I will say offensive to me is that middle part that says, we generally recommend against following modern medical practices, including medical testing, drugs, vaccinations, and surgery. That could not be farther from the truth. We work in conjunction with medical doctors, osteopaths, you know, the conventional medical system all the time. Additionally, we are trained and do use drugs in our practice. I use pharmaceuticals in my practice all the time because that's what's accessible to my patients and that's what they can do and what they can afford. And I think there's always a time and a place for everything. I'm not going to recommend natural treatments to somebody if it's not what's going to keep them safe and if it's not going to be effective for them. Additionally, we do, you know, lots of lab tests and imaging and all the standard kind of diagnostic procedures. We do definitely, if somebody comes in for a broken arm, we are not going to try to fix that with an herb. We are going to send you to the hospital. And vaccinations is, you know, I don't know how things are in the United Kingdom or elsewhere, but very controversial subject in the United States right now. But I will say that our clinic at the university where I work, we provide vaccinations. We are in the Vaccines for Children program, which is a federally funded program to provide vaccinations to low-income and uninsured children. So, you know, I think that we are doing our part to make sure that public health is looked after with vaccinations as well. And I think that there are always people, you know, there are people on the fringe of every kind of medicine or every profession that are going to have views that aren't in line with the majority of the profession. And unfortunately, those people are often the more vocal or the more, they get a lot of press because it's shock value.
Well, absolutely. And I think what we're witnessing here on Wikipedia is just lumping in a whole load of people who maybe have no ethics. They're a quack, let's say.
Right.
They have no qualifications. They have no training. We have these people across every field of mm-hmm. health and medicine. You know, somebody who flunked their medical degree and what they've seemed to have done here in this Wikipedia definition is lumped all those people in alongside highly trained people as yourself. There's obviously a bit of an agenda here from some of these editors who don't like what you do. So I'm happy to have you here and, you know, defend the corner.
Yeah, me too.
And, and say, no, this is not the case, what you're reading here in Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. So just going back to some of the things you mentioned. So for instance, we probably think of natural supplements and herbs. I like the way Americans call them herbs. We call them herbs here in the UK. But you, as you said, you'll also prescribe pharmaceutical meds as well, if necessary.
Absolutely.
Can you give us an example of where somebody might come in with a condition and you actually send them out, you know, to back to Big Pharma? And that's not something someone would expect from a naturopath.
Yeah, I mean, I do it every day. You know, I see patients who are, you know, potentially uninsured. So I would love to be able to recommend, you know, them using herbs for their high blood pressure. Herbs can work for that. Herbs can be really good for people who are able to access that. But, you know, if they're really not able to afford that, I would rather them spend their money on eating more vegetables, eating more whole grains, you know, joining a gym, like those kinds of things that are going to have bigger impacts than just taking an herb. So in that case, in the United States, we have these $4 medications that you can get at some pharmacies. I'm going to choose a $4 medication that they can get, you know, $4 for a month's worth of medication for their blood pressure. And in addition to that, I'm going to talk to them about how to manage their stress. I'm going to talk to them about what foods they need to eat and how to exercise to also bring down blood pressure. So really kind of looking at the whole person and giving them a treatment plan that's not just the medication, but kind of includes everything else as well.
Great, great. Josh, I just want to talk about this, going back to this idea of the whole body, the whole organism, because there's an intersection here, isn't there, between what you do and, let's say, for want of a better word, ancient medicine. So I'm talking specifically about Chinese medicine, mm-hmm. and Ayurvedic practice. And I believe some of those things are taught at the university where you studied. But how does what you do fit into these kind of practices? And how do they also fit into our sort of Western notions of health and medicine as well? I know that's a massive, huge question.
Yeah, it is a huge question, but I think that it's a really important question. It's something that in this day and age, we're really starting to see that these kind of alternative complementary forms of medicine are effective for treating tons of conditions. They don't necessarily neatly fit into the Western conventional medical model of how to practice or how to study them. So I think that going forward, kind of the next step in figuring things out is understanding how do we research these things, how do we apply them to clinical practice, and how do we, you know, make sure that they're working all together. I did not study Chinese medicine or Ayurveda, but those, we do have programs in those at the university where I work now. And I think that they all, you know, obviously work really well together because they are whole systems. You know, Ayurveda and Chinese medicine obviously are going to have their own philosophies about health and disease and kind of their own diagnostic patterns. But students in the naturopathic program are able to study those systems as well. And then I think it's really cool because they're able to kind of integrate Western diagnostic knowledge and they have the knowledge of the conventional treatments and the Western herbs and nutrition, but they also have this really great, you know, whole other medical system that kind of dovetails nicely, so they can treat patients from a lot of different angles and perspectives.
How do you deal with skepticism? It's very common, isn't it, to just reject these things out of hand and saying, not interested. Certainly, there's a lot of people who don't have an open mind, but there's a lot of people as well that will completely reject and pour scorn on the kind of things that we're talking about, natural medicine, Eastern medicines.
Yeah, absolutely.
How would you defend them?
Well, I think I would say that, I mean, for me, everything is patient-centered. So it's up to you. It's up to what you want to do. If you don't want to try it, that's totally up to you. I would probably cite the growing body of evidence on acupuncture as being a very effective tool for headaches, chronic low back pain, insomnia, addiction, allergies. There's a growing body of evidence on acupuncture as being very effective for those things. So we are studying them. We do have an evidence base for these practices. You know, it's not just a bunch of hogwash. It really does work. And I think that oftentimes we see people that have kind of they've gone the conventional medical route. They've seen lots of doctors, they've seen lots of specialists, and nothing has seemed to work for them. So it's kind of, okay, well, there's nothing left to lose. I might as well try this stuff that I didn't think I was, you know, interested in. So we see those people. I think it's nice to, you know, to be able to show them that sometimes the really foundational natural things do have a big impact, like adjusting your diet or sleeping better or managing your stress, like all of these things that we can work on with food and herbs and, you know, acupuncture and all that kind of stuff. Like those make a huge difference in how we feel.
Okay. So let's dive in. Now you treat a whole range of different health issues at your practice, but we want to talk about sleep today because that's what we do.
Right.
So pharmaceutical sleeping pills and herbs and supplements. Broadly, how would you contrast those two? I know we've got lots of divisions within different types of pharmaceuticals and also different types of herbs, but what's the broad distinction between those two approaches?
I think for me in my practice, kind of the biggest distinction is the how strong something might be. So like, you know, there are really strong sleep medications that are pretty much just going to knock you out. Whereas I think a lot of herbs and nutrients are going to be a little bit more gentle. I also like to choose herbs kind of based on the whole picture. So is there anxiety? Is there muscle tension? Is there, you know, an overwhelming amount of stress? All of those things can kind of give me an idea of what kind of herb I might pick that might help in that specific pathway. Whereas pharmaceuticals, I think, just kind of generally are broader and work a little bit harder. Lots of people, especially if they're coming to see me, are willing to try natural things first to see if they work. And if they do, then great. We don't have to go any further. And if they don't, then, you know, I'm happy to keep working with the patient until they're, you know, they're satisfied and they're on, you know, healthier. I will say that in, you know, my work with people who are in recovery from drugs and alcohol, I often do prescribe medications to help people sleep. Because drugs mess with neurotransmitters, and when that's been a pattern for a really long time, it can take a long time for people to kind of get back in that natural rhythm of things. And so just getting them to sleep more than 2 or 3 hours a night, to me, is way more important than, you know, let's use something natural first. I want them actually sleeping, and then we can work on all of those other foundational pieces later.
So when you go and see your regular doctor, why do none of them recommend herbs or supplements?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to training.
Might be a really naive question for me.
No, I don't think so at all. I think a lot of it comes down to training and they don't learn about those things in school. So I think it's pretty natural to just not recommend things that you don't know if they work. If you don't know the evidence behind them, if you don't know how they're used or how they're dosed or how they're going to interact with the drugs that someone might be taking, I mean, I wouldn't recommend them either. But I am fortunate that I have training in those areas, so I'm happy to talk about all those things with my patients.
Okay. Efficacy of these herbs and these supplements, where does that come from? That's obviously through your training, and you say there is research there. How do you test and monitor, and how does that work? You know, trying to find out if something's going to work, if it's working, if you need to try something else.
Right. Efficacy, and I know we're going to talk more specifics later, but, you know, it's, for me, it's built on where the evidence is, what the research has shown. For a lot of these things, the body of research is pretty small at this point, but that to me just means we need more studies. We need more people looking at these natural treatments and, you know, proving that they're effective. The studies that I'm going to talk about later have shown positive effects. So let's take that and build on it. As far as, you know, knowing how long to try something, I think that kind of depends on the patient for me. If it's someone who's having, you know, a lot of difficulty with sleep and it's really affecting their kind of daily life, I might only do a 1 or 2 week trial of something before we move on to something stronger. Whereas if it's just like, oh, I have occasional insomnia and it's kind of annoying, but it doesn't really affect my daily life, then, you know, let's try this for a month or so and see how that works. I kind of base it on what's going on with the person and their sleep and their kind of overall symptoms. And I'll say that also a lot of, especially with herbs, a lot of the knowledge that we have about how these plants are used is from historical use. We have thousands of years of evidence of these plants being used for sleep or for relaxing people or for anxiety or stress. You know, some of the herbs that we're going to talk about later have been used, honestly, for thousands of years for those things. So I think that is a part of the pyramid of evidence. It's not a placebo-controlled trial, so it's maybe not a rigorous scientific trial, but it is evidence that people have used this for hundreds of years, thousands of years with success. And I think that's we take that and we build on it.
So I'm interested, how does a treatment for someone with a sleep condition who would come to visit you, for instance, how does that fit into standard classifications of sleep disorders? So we have we have the ICSD, which is the standard diagnostic list of all the sleep disorders. You'll diagnose a patient based on these criteria. Do you work at all within those, or is it completely separate, or do you use those things as guidelines alongside your treatment? How does that dovetail into the way that people deal with sleep disorders through the more traditional routes, let's say?
Sure. Well, I think in my practice, and I think really in the state where I practice, we refer to specialists a lot. So if it's something, if it's functional insomnia kind of, happens a few times a week, that's something I'm totally comfortable treating. When we start getting into more, advanced sleep disorders, I think that is a place for a specialist to come in and, do the diagnosis, do the workup, set the treatment, and then we will figure out ways to support people. For instance, obstructive sleep apnea, is a really common sleep disorder. Using these sedative herbs or supplements or sleeping pills, for that matter, with obstructive sleep apnea is not a good idea, because that can make the sleep apnea worse. So I think understanding the diagnosis and really understanding what's going on with the patient is very important before, I make any kind of recommendations.
A couple more questions here, and then we're going to sort of talk about some of the actual supplements and herbs themselves and drill down into them. So over-the-counter supplements, so things you can buy from the chemist, the pharmacist, without a prescription. And often these are blends of different supplements. Often, they're big brands that we've heard of. How does that fit into all of these topics that we're talking about today?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that can be most confusing for consumers, is that, how do you choose a good supplement? What is good? What is bad? In the United States, and I'm sorry, I don't know how it works in the UK, but dietary supplements are not regulated in the same way that medications are. So the quality differences between supplements, the quality varies a lot. There was a scandal, obviously, a few years ago, where a team of people from the state of New York looked at what was actually in over-the-counter supplements that people were buying at, at kind of the big box department stores or drug stores, and found that most of the time they didn't have any active ingredient in them, or if they did, it was not a therapeutic dose, and it's being marketed and sold and there's not anything actually in it. So I think talking to someone who knows what supplement brands or supplement companies have done third-party independent research to make sure that their, products are not contaminated and they have active ingredient in them. And, oftentimes these supplement companies, kind of the more professional brands that I use, are also supporting research on their products, so they have something to back it up. I think that that's really important, and talking to someone who knows about that. So if that's a, some integrative general practitioner, or if it's, naturopathic doctor, just kind of finding a source for understanding what is good, what is bad, and how to pick a good supplement, I think is really important.
You're generally just going to be at the mercy of potentially snake oil salespeople marketing products, which, as you say, some of them may not have any active ingredients at all. And there's going to be loads and loads of products out there that maybe someone's heard about on social media and they said, oh, you know, I saw this advert and I tried it and it was great. And then people learn word of mouth. But that's not the best way of finding out, really.
No, it's not. And it's really challenging for me when I see patients. You know, as I said, about 30% of my practice is complementary care. So though I do have patients who come in with three or four new supplements every time, they're like, oh, well, I read on Facebook or I saw on TV or I read an advertisement, about this product and I started taking it just based on the advertisements. And it's hard for me as their doctor to be like, well, you know, it's probably, if it's being advertised that much, it's probably not something you need to be taking because it's probably not been studied. It's not something that you should put yourself on anyway. So I always recommend that people talk to someone before they just decide to start taking a supplement. That's just, I think, a good standard practice. The other thing is a lot of these, for me, a lot of these blended products that have, you know, 12 different herbs in them to help you sleep, they don't have a therapeutic dose of any of the herbs. So they may or may not be effective, but I think, you know, from my practice, I tend to go toward supplements or herbal products that are one or maybe two different herbs, just so I know that there is actually a therapeutic dose of that plant in it.
Yeah.
Because if you're not getting enough, it's not going to work. And then you're going to think that, you know, this herb never works. All supplements are bad. It's really easy to kind of go down that road of this didn't work, so nothing works. And I think that's, unfortunately, the experience that a lot of people have had with supplements and herbs. And I think it's also really important for people to, you know, if they're taking other medications, to make sure that they're checking with someone before they take any kind of supplement, because just because something is natural does not mean that it is inherently safe. Natural products can do harm just as much as drugs can do harm. And making sure that you're not going to have any, you know, scary interactions, that's really important to keep yourself and, you know, for me, to keep my patients safe.
Well, another good reason to talk to somebody who knows what they're talking about rather than, you know, Facebook or whatever. So, okay, this isn't really in your practice, but I wanted to bring it up, two sort of popular topics, and we can just talk about these briefly. I just wanted to get your opinion.
Sure.
Melatonin and cannabis, medicinal cannabis.
Yes, melatonin, that's something I see a lot, you know, in my practice as far as people choosing something for sleep that's natural. It's widely known, it's easily accessible. The issue that I have with melatonin is that people take really high doses of it. There's evidence that a third of a gram to a half gram of melatonin is just as effective as 1 gram milligrams, 1 milligram or 3 milligrams, where, you know, half a milligram is as effective as 3 milligrams. So I think that people are just taking way too much of it. I worry about suppressing endogenous melatonin production. I also think that in general, just because you're not sleeping, it doesn't mean that you don't have enough melatonin in your body. So we're giving the body extra melatonin without knowing that that's actually what's going on. And I don't think that that's a good way to treat. So I use melatonin pretty sparingly in my practice. I use it for some people. I think there's good evidence on it for sleep, you know, regulating sleep cycles in certain groups of people, people with Alzheimer's disease, people with Parkinson's disease. But in general, I don't recommend it as kind of a one size fits all approach to sleep.
Sorry, Josh, one more thing on melatonin. I know that if you're sourcing it yourself, you know, buying it online or whatever, then there's no real guarantee of the strength of the product anyway.
Absolutely.
So I guess some people may, you know, they may be taking some and it's not doing anything and then just taking more.
Exactly. And it may not be melatonin at all. It may just be, you know, fillers and the capsule. So that, again, that kind of goes back to understanding where you're buying your supplements and what brands the supplements are, for sure.
Sorry, I interrupted.
Oh, no, that's
you
okay.
About cannabis.
Yeah, cannabis. It is legal in the state of Oregon, both for medicinal and recreational uses. It's legal in, I don't know how many states for medicinal use, but I think around half of the states in the U.S. And for recreational use in 6 or 8 now. This is something that I see people using a lot in my practice. It's not in the scope of my practice in the state of Oregon to prescribe or recommend cannabis, so I don't know a lot about it, and I obviously don't recommend it to my patients just because that's practicing outside my scope. I think it's really interesting, for, you know, kind of in the past 5 years that it's been legal for recreational use here, to see the explosion of CBD products. And, you know, marijuana is just the, or cannabis is just kind of the cure-all for everything. And I think that that's honestly really dangerous. It's a substance that, you know, I think does have a lot of medicinal value, but we haven't been able to study that in this country or in most countries because it's been illegal for so long. So we don't know long-term effects of using it, you know, on the, if you're smoking it, on the lungs or the cardiovascular system. And if you're, you know, eating it, we don't know the long-term effects on the nervous system or the GI system. We just don't know these things. So I think that reaching for that as especially a long-term solution is potentially harmful.
Well, it's a huge industry now, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Venture capital flooding into, you know, big billion-dollar industries. I think you're right. I think there's a, because access is there now, maybe seeing it as a cure-all.
Agreed. And I, you know, people are using it, whether or not they're talking to their providers about it. But I think if you are using it, just talking to your doctors about it and making sure that it is safe for you based on the limited research that we have, I think that's just a smart thing to do. And I think that this just goes back to, natural does not necessarily equal safe. And that's one argument that, you know, I've always heard for cannabis is, well, it's natural. It's not really a drug. It's a plant. And I have studied herbal medicine for years, and I know that just because something is a plant does not mean it's not going to hurt you. And it does not mean that it doesn't have long-term side effects. So I think really doing your research and, you know, kind of taking a common sense approach to things is important, as well as talking to your doctor about whatever supplements you're using, whether they're a traditional supplement or cannabis.
Okay, so we're going to have a look at specifically different types of herbs and supplements that you recommend and you use in your practice, Josh. Actually, I'll read them off first. So we've got valerian, passion flower, ashwagandha, did I say that right? Chamomile, hops, kava, magnesium.
Yeah, phosphatidylserine.
Phosphatidylserine, okay, and 5-HTP. Mm-hmm. So why don't you go from the top of the list? And most people probably heard of some of these.
Sure. So I think valerian is, you know, one of the most common ones that people are familiar with as being an herb for sleep. Valerian is from the root of the plant, so it can be used in a tincture, which is an ethanol and water-based extraction. It can also be used in a tea. I think that the taste is pretty strong in a tea because it's a root. So you're probably not going to find plain valerian tea. You'll probably find it in a blend of something that's a little bit more palatable. You can also find valerian capsules pretty easily. And that one, you know, historically, valerian obviously is used as a sedative and kind of a relaxing herb, but also has been used for body pains and muscle pains and those kinds of things, because it can also work as an antispasmodic. So it kind of has more applications than just being used for sleep. So I think that in my practice, it's not one that I recommend very frequently. I just see people who have tried this because it's a pretty common one.
So why are a lot of people taking valerian then? Is it more readily available?
I think it is readily available and promoted for sleep. You know, there are a number of research studies on valerian that have looked at the effects on sleep, and so that has made it easier to market, and I think more people are familiar with that one than a lot of the other ones on this list. So it's kind of a go-to if you're going to try an herbal supplement for sleep. One of the issues with valerian that I've seen in practice is that a small percentage of people can have a paradoxical reaction to it. So instead of relaxing you and making you nice and sleepy, it actually revs you up and makes you wide awake. So again, that's another reason that I don't use this one a ton in my own practice, because that can happen with some people.
Yeah. There's no way of telling.
There's no way of telling. And, you know, it's kind of the opposite effect that we're going for.
Yeah.
But people don't like that.
It's useful to know about any of these side effects as well, you know, as you go through the list.
Sure. Passionflower is one that I use really frequently in my own practice because I think it's a really great just calming herb in general. It works on GABA receptors in the brain in a similar but different fashion to benzodiazepines. So benzodiazepines are sometimes used short term to promote, you know, sleep, but this herb is working on the same receptors, but just in a little bit different way. So I find that it works really well for anxiety, nervousness, and for helping people sleep. There's animal research to support the use for sleep in general, but also there have been a couple small trials on it to look at its effects on sleep quality in, you know, healthy adults and have shown that it's effective. And I think this one is a good one for, again, just anxiety, nervousness, those kinds of things that can impact our sleep. So that's one I would choose for that.
Okay.
Ashwagandha is I feel like it's becoming very popular because, I don't know in the UK, but in the US, I think adaptogens is a term that's getting thrown around a lot. Basically what an adaptogen is in herbalism, when we think about it, is it's a plant that helps your body adjust to stress. So there are a number of different adaptogenic herbs that are going to kind of work on the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis and can help our bodies respond to stress better. Ashwagandha is a common one. It's a popular one. It's been used in Ayurvedic medicine for thousands of years. It comes from India. It's kind of used as a general tonic in Ayurvedic medicine, but its scientific name, the species name, is Somnifera. So it promotes sleep as well. Probably because, you know, general tonic, stress, anxiety, kind of helping us deal with all that. Sleep is a really big part of how our bodies and our minds respond to that. And it also works on the GABA pathways in the brain. And, you know, good results on stress, anxiety in small studies. Animal models have shown that it's good for sleep, but this is more a kind of traditional use, been used for sleep and in general for kind of healthy stress response and dealing with kind of adapting to our environment since it's an adaptogen.
I'm just going to pause you there on this list. You know, we've got a list of supplements here and herbs. What's the process of choosing one over the other?
Talking about the three that we've talked about, valerian, passionflower, ashwagandha, if I'm talking to a patient and I feel like, you know, they're telling me that they can't get to sleep at night because, you know, their thoughts are racing and they can't stop thinking about what's going to happen tomorrow and what happened today and have that anxious picture, that might be something that I choose passionflower for. Whereas if it's someone who, you know, they're really stressed at work and life is just kind of hard right now and they're not sleeping well and they just kind of feel overwhelmed, that might be more something that I choose ashwagandha for because that's going to support that healthy adrenal stress response better than something like passionflower. So I think that's where I really try to blend the science of what I know from the research and the art of picking something for an individual person.
Great. I'll let you carry on with the list.
Thanks. Chamomile, that's a really popular one for sleep as well. I think that's, you know, that's when everybody has chamomile tea in their house. I know we always had that when I was growing up. It's very popular, you know, to use as a tea. It can be helpful for sleep and also anxiety, restlessness, nervousness. There have been a number of studies on it. One specifically, a couple I looked at, one in elderly individuals, one in postpartum women for both mood and sleep support. You know, it shows improvement in sleep. It seems to work best kind of in the moment. Like I had a really stressful day and I need something to kind of ease me into sleep. Chamomile tea might be a good choice for that because it's not something that you have to take long term to see the effects. It's something you can have a cup of tea, relax a little bit, and then get to sleep.
So with chamomile, I mean, you can go to the supermarket and buy chamomile tea. It's got to have a mildish effect.
Yeah, it's pretty mild. So again, this is not something that I'm using very commonly in my practice because it's usually something that people have tried or they're kind of beyond this mild of an intervention. I think that if you're, you know, choosing a chamomile tea, organic is best because it doesn't have pesticides in it. And trying to get a good quality is important. So, you know, researching, I don't know what tea companies are available in the UK, but I know the companies that I would recommend in the United States, because I think that they are, you know, high quality products that have had third party testing to ensure that what they're saying is in there is actually in there.
Okay.
Next is hops, which I think is widely used as a as an herbal extract in beer. You know, you can think of beer as a hops, an alcohol hops extract.
We're not talking about drinking beer.
No, we're not. Although, you know, drinking alcohol to get, you know, it does help you fall asleep. You don't have restful sleep. But the hops in beer actually, again, works on the GABA receptors in the brain. So it does potentiate sleep. And in animal studies, it's been shown to improve and regulate the sleep-wake cycle. That hasn't been studied in humans for that. There have been a couple small trials using hops with valerian, for example, that have shown improvements. But again, that's a combination product. So I think that this is more a traditional use has been for, you know, it's a relaxing kind of sedating herb in a gentle way. But just because you're drinking beer before bed doesn't mean you're getting the medicinal benefits of the hops.
And that's the alcohol rather than the
exactly the case, exactly I mean, I guess unless you're doing a really freshly hopped India pale ale, you know, which you can get in Portland, Oregon for sure, but I don't know how widely available that is elsewhere in the world.
Making me want to go to the fridge now. So how would you take hops as a herbal treatment for sleep?
Sure. It's available in some teas, but also there are tinctures of it, which again is an alcohol extraction. The difference between a tincture of hops and hops and beer is that it's actually the hops are put into alcohol and water for a number of months and all of the constituents are pulled out. So it's a really concentrated form of it. Whereas in beer, you know, there's hops for flavor, but you're not getting a ton of medicinal value from it.
Okay. Kava. That's the one.
Yeah. Kava. I wanted to talk about that just because I see, again, this is one I see with patients here in the United States, and I'm not sure what the legal status of kava is in the UK. Are you familiar with that at all?
I've got a feeling that it's not legal. I'm not sure 100%.
Right. Yeah. And I know in Australia, it seems to be not legal to sell, but not illegal to use. So it's one of those, like, if you have it, you may be able to use it, but I don't know the legal status of it, you know, in countries around the world. I think that it's used in the United States because it's not, you know, it's not regulated here. It has been studied for sleep disturbances, again, related to anxiety. It's primarily used in kind of, you know.
It's banned.
Okay.
It's banned in the UK.
Yeah, it's used here for anxiety, maybe sleep problems related to anxiety. And, you know, small research trials may have shown effect, but this is not a go-to that I have for managing either anxiety or sleep, just because the legal status is questionable in so many places around the world. And even in the South Pacific, where kava originates, there are issues with using this as a, you know, a drug of abuse.
Can you explain what it is?
Yeah, it's a root from a plant that grows in the South Pacific, and traditionally it's used in like a tea ceremony that is, you know, a very big part of the culture in the South Pacific, and it's, you know, known for its kind of sedative, hypnotic effects.
It's got a lot stronger effect than, well, chamomile, for instance, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think depending on how strong the, you know, the tea or the tincture that you get is, it can have a really strong effect. You know, it can give you tingly lips if you're drinking the tea. It can make you feel real kind of chilled out and woozy if you're not used to it. So it's not one that I really would mess around with, because it is one of the stronger ones on this list.
Yeah. I think the reason it's banned is because there are quite some serious side effects.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what I was just going to say, is that, you know, besides all of that, there have been a number of reports of liver damage from kava. You know, some people are saying that maybe that's not from the kava itself. It's from alcohol in addition to kava used at the same time, but, you know, did the kava potentiate that effect? Did it make it worse? Was it, you know, the kava on its own? I think that there's a lot of questions for me as a practitioner, so it's not something that I use in my practice.
Yeah, again, it's one of these things that have been used for a long time.
Right. And I think, you know, this comes into, you know, the conversation about, you know, we are taking traditional medicines and we are taking medicines from around the world and we're taking them out of context and we're taking them out of their traditional use and turning them into more of a, it becomes more of a drug in that sense. Like, it's not that different from a pharmaceutical. If we're turning this into a supplement and just recommending that people take it, you've totally taken it out of the historical context. So I think that is really dangerous, and it opens lots of conversations about, you know, equity and sustainability and ethics in medicine. But I think kava has plenty of reasons to stay away from it.
Okay. Next one, magnesium.
Yeah, magnesium.
That's quite a hot sort of topic at the moment, isn't it? There's a lot of people talking about magnesium.
It is, yeah. People love magnesium right now. And I think for good reason. There's, you know, there's not as much magnesium in our food supply from depletion in the soil. And I think a lot of people don't eat foods where they would get magnesium. So it's in really high levels in nuts and seeds, avocados, leafy greens, whole grains, and in the United States, kind of a standard American, standard Western diet. Those are not things that are really prevalent in the diet. So we're not getting a ton of magnesium in our diet. So I think, you know, a lot of people are kind of looking to this as a way to supplement away those dietary deficiencies. And I always think it's best to get your nutrients from food. So if I'm going to recommend that someone takes magnesium, I'm also going to tell them how to get magnesium from their food, because that's how we're supposed to get nutrients. We're not supposed to get them from supplements. But I think that it can be really effective for, you know, treating insomnia, you know, in the short term. And I use it a lot in my practice because it is a really gentle, relaxing, kind of easy way for people to treat insomnia.
Why has it come to the fore recently as a sleep supplement in particular?
I can't really speak to why it's come to the forefront as a sleep supplement. I think that all minerals and vitamins kind of go through these phases of being, you know, the new hot thing. We just had that with vitamin D for the past few years. I remember in the 90s, it was vitamin C. Like everybody was taking vitamin C for everything. So I think we get research about these vitamins or minerals, and then supplement companies and, you know, really latch onto that and start promoting it a lot. And it kind of becomes part of the, you know, the public mindset that, oh, magnesium is good for sleep. You know, personally, I think that magnesium is great for sleep, especially if you have anxiety or muscle tension, or, you know, you're trying to get to sleep after working out. I think it can be really effective for that.
Okay. The next one I'd not heard of before you suggested this, and I'll let you pronounce it again.
Yeah, it's a supplement called phosphatidylserine. So this is one that I use in my practice and one that I see people taking sometimes. It's often in kind of those sleep blends that are blends of herbs and nutrients. It's serine is an amino acid, and it's been studied mostly for its effect on like cognitive function, memory support, those kinds of things, but also a little bit studied in sleep. So I see this taken more for kind of improving the quality of sleep throughout the night, not getting to sleep, but kind of staying asleep. One study actually looked at it with omega-3 fatty acids. So, you know, getting those oftentimes from fish oil, looked at the combination and saw that also, it could improve cortisol regulation, so the stress response. Again, this is one of those kind of adaptogenic things that we think about in our, you know, naturopathic medicine. This might go really well with ashwagandha as being a supportive of the stress response and kind of the, you know, that picture.
Again, what are we looking at here? Are these is this a capsule? Is it a tincture?
This one is a capsule. This one's always encapsulated because it's an amino acid. You know, amino acids are going to come from the proteins in our food. So making sure that you're getting plenty of high quality protein, protein from different sources, plant proteins, animal proteins, is a little bit different, the composition. But I think just in general, understanding that protein is an important piece of the diet and making sure that you're getting enough of it, you know, is helpful. Oftentimes people who might have issues kind of waking up in the middle of the night I will suggest that they do a small high protein snack before bed, just because I think that can be helpful for some people with blood sugar regulation during the night. But also, if it's protein, it may have higher amounts of certain, serine, tryptophan, those amino acids that are going to be more supportive of sleep.
Okay, so last one on the list, 5-HTP.
Sure. Yeah. So it's 5-HTP is 5-hydroxytryptophan, which again is an amino acid. 5-HTP feeds into the serotonin-melatonin pathway. 5-HTP, after a couple steps, is turned into serotonin by the body, which is then, after a couple more steps, turned into melatonin. So kind of the theory behind taking this supplement for sleep is that you're giving your body the building blocks for making more melatonin. So instead of giving it melatonin directly, you're going back a few steps and giving it the pieces that it needs to work with, and then the body will make melatonin. I think that's great in theory. And I think in animal model research, we've seen that it may be beneficial for sleep, but there hasn't really been very much as far as human research for this specific supplement. I know a lot of people use it for mood support and for, sleep kind of as a, in conjunction with mood support. But again, this is not one that I use super frequently in my own practice.
That's a great roundup, Josh. I really appreciate that. Now, I don't want you to give any, prescriptive answers here, but just generally as guidelines, one of the things that people talk about a lot is, how much should I take? What's the dosage? And obviously, I'm not going to ask you to go and say you take this amount of that, but are there any sort of general ways to look at this, or any resources that people can use to maybe not make big mistakes in either taking too much or too little?
Sure. I think that, following the recommendation of the manufacturer, as long as you're getting a high quality supplement, is important, because they're going to base that, they're going to be more likely to base that on the research, and it's going to be more likely to actually have enough of the active ingredient in it to get the desired effect. There are websites that are available that I think are good resources. One called examine.com is one that I have seen patients use and used myself to kind of check dosages on different supplements, because in research, there is often a really wide range of dosages studied. I would also say that, with sleep, starting low, starting very gentle is probably the best kind of course of action. You don't want to hit things too hard, because even though these are natural supplements or herbs, they can, you can feel groggy or kind of have that sleep hangover feeling when you wake up if you take too much of it. And additionally, I think it's really, really important, if you are taking anything else, to talk to someone about potential interactions, because all of these sedative calming herbs, they work great. But if you're already taking medications that are working on the central nervous system or are sedatives, that can have additive effects that can end up being really dangerous. So you don't want to do or take anything without medical advice if you're already on prescription medications.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Josh. Is there anything we've skipped or anything that you want to tag onto this, this discussion?
I would say, kind of back to our earlier conversation about naturopathic medicine in general, if people are in the United States or Canada, checking out the website is naturopathic.org. That's run by the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians. So that can give you an idea of exactly what our training is and what we do in the different states and how we're licensed. And in the United States, especially, because we do have regulated, trained naturopathic doctors, making sure that you are seeking them out instead of just, listening to anyone who says they're an expert in natural medicine. Kind of understanding who your people are and where they come from and how they were trained, I think, is really important.
What about people from outside of the states?
There's a World Naturopathic Federation. I'm not very familiar with how that works. I do know that there are naturopathic doctors who were trained in the United States who practice outside the United States, not as doctors, obviously, but just kind of as health coaches and wellness advocates and consultants. So not in a diagnosing or treating capacity, but just in an educational capacity. So it may be possible in other countries to find that as well.
And your website is
drjoshcorn.com. And then I also, I'm pretty active on Instagram and post a lot of information there and studies. And my Instagram is dr.joshcorn. It's dr.joshcorn at Instagram. So yeah, I welcome people, you know, following me, emailing me with questions. Happy to talk to people.
There you go. If you want to know about any of this stuff, go and follow Josh on Instagram. Awesome. That was really interesting. I learned a lot of stuff.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. All right. Thanks, Josh.
All right. Thank you. Have a great one.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And you can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and on the website sleepjunkies.com. Hope to see you on the next episode. Sleep well.